This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Not everybody has the means or the time to do it, but sitting around the table for a proper family-style meal, complete with protein, vegetables, and dessert, is a long-standing American tradition. Or is it? When did how and what we eat become codified as right, proper, and essentially American? Abigail Carroll is a food historian and author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal, which explores the history of America's eating from the colonial era to the present. She joined Virginia last year to discuss her book.
And Abigail, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Virginia.
It's interesting that you use the term invention of the American meal. And one of the things that comes across is the way that most of us grew up in America eating three square meals a day is not a tradition, but a construct, an adaptation. Was that a surprise to you?
A little bit. I think, just like you said, we do tend to just think of the meal as unchanging, as static. But it's something that a lot of people have had their hands in, and each generation has reinvented. And as our circumstances have changed, so have our meals. I argue in the book that the shape of the meal really is in so many ways the shape of society. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that as society changes, so does the meal. But it hasn't just changed and evolved sort of naturally. It's also changed because we've wanted it to change. And we've had different ideas and different ways of defining the meal over time.
Talk a little bit about the evolution of American eating back to the colonial period. A lot of detail we get on the diets of working people and the landed gentry, which ate very differently from each other.
That's right. In the very early colonial days, for the most part, people were eating a hot meal in the middle of the day, and that's the meal that they called dinner. And they were rising early. They were eating a sort of ad hoc breakfast and an ad hoc supper, which is to say perhaps leftovers from dinner, perhaps heated, but perhaps not, perhaps with others, perhaps alone. Breakfast and supper were very much like glorified snacks. And the dinner often came out of a single pot. You had often one-pot meals. And people were not gathering around a table for dinner and putting on their best manners and catching up about each other's day, because they were often working together on a farm or in a family business, and they didn't have to catch up with each other. And, they were eating very rustically. It was a while before the fork appeared. And for many years, you know, bread was doing the work of the spoon in terms of sopping up juices and whatnot. People often just put a board across two trestles and brought up a bench, some wooden crates, or simply, you know, squatted or leaned against the wall in the very early days if there wasn't enough chairs for everyone. So the meal looked very different in those days. But it changed quite drastically during the Industrial Revolution.
How did that change? When people moved off the land, obviously not working side by side with each other necessarily in the family anymore, what happened to meals then?
Well, people had to accommodate changing work schedules. You know, they were leaving the farms for factories. They were leaving the country for the city. They were working farther from where they lived, and they couldn't necessarily return home in the middle of the day for a hot meal. And even if they could, you know, if they were working in an office or at a desk, a hot meal would have probably done them in for the rest of the day, such as a farmer's dinner. And so they shifted dinner to the evening when it became really a social time. This is when dinner became special, because the evening was special. It was the time that the family had together, having been separated now during the day. Dinner also changed from a one-pot meal to, in the 1700s, a kind of pudding and roast type of a meal. And in the 19th century, in the Victorian era, it became a French-inspired meal, which is to say not only French-inspired foods, but perhaps even more importantly, courses. People were starting, you know, with soup. They were ending with dessert. They might have a green salad after their entree. And so dinner looked a lot different then than it had in the colonial period.
You spend a couple of chapters on the rise of dinner to a place of primacy in most of our families and diets. It's come to symbolize a great deal, family unity for one thing, but you give some data on the role it serves even in educating families. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. You know, children were not necessarily expected to participate in, you know, dinner time conversation at the table. In the colonial era, there just wasn't a lot of conversation to be had necessarily to begin with. But during the Victorian era, with the emergence of the middle class, this is when families really celebrated formality and etiquette and manners, and they taught their children not to put their elbows on the table, etc. And, you know, children were being trained in what it meant to be middle class, what it meant to be respectable, so that when they grew up and attended a formal dinner party, which was very popular during this era, they would know how to hold their own, and they would come across as proper and respectable. And so they trained them, you know, in manners, but part of that was just simply how to hold a conversation.
We're speaking with Abigail Carroll. She's a food historian. She's written for several publications like the New York Times and has taught at BU. She's the author of the new book, Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. We have this idea that traditional rituals like the evening meal have been thrown aside by contemporary life. Everybody sitting down together is this idea we have, but it's not true. I mean, people, you pointed out, people didn't always sit at tables. And you also write about the stander-uppers, you know, people who ate standing up and ate separately in many families.
Yeah, well, think about fast food. The origins of fast food are really the quick lunch. So very late 19th century and early 20th century, this is when you have people working in cities, at factories, and lunch has really come to fill in that gap now between breakfast and dinner when, you know, dinner shifted to the evening. And because dinner was so special, lunch didn't have to be. And so lunch was really this stopgap meal. It was emphasis on quick, on often cold, although not always, and cheap. But quick was really the big thing. And that was, of course, so that you could get right back to work and that you could be productive and that you could be profitable. And so the quick lunch venue emerges. This is when cafeterias emerge and eventually automats where, you know, you can just drop a coin in a slot, open a door, take out your pie, drop another coin in another slot, open the door, retrieve a coffee, and the idea of eating in 20 minutes or 15, and in some cases 5, not even sitting down. Many of these places didn't even have tables. They had chairs. Think about a classroom where you have the sort of desk as part of the chair as mm-hmm. one unit. Well, they had these what they called one-armed joints. A one-armed joint was a restaurant that you would go to where you could grab your food cafeteria style, bring it to a chair that had a wraparound table, a little depression for your coffee cup, and you could wolf it down without the, you know, need to socialize or waste time talking with anybody.
Why cereal, eggs, and pancakes for breakfast, but never for lunch or dinner?
Well, breakfast used to be one of those meals where it didn't matter what you ate. There weren't specific foods you associated just with breakfast. You had leftovers for breakfast. And in the 1800s, you often had a breakfast that looked a lot more like dinner because meat became very central to breakfast. And you might have porridge with your meat or breakfast cakes such as muffins or biscuits. But in the mid to late 19th century, with the Industrial Revolution and the change in lifestyles, people couldn't eat that farmer's breakfast anymore because it just made for a bad case of indigestion. And so this is when health reformers such as Sylvester Graham and later John Harvey Kellogg were experimenting with the farinaceous breakfast, which is to say the grain-based breakfast. And breakfast cereal is invented at sanitariums where people went to seek health from various maladies, namely indigestion. And then breakfast cereal colonizes a meal and becomes iconic of that meal.
Well, of course, the history of how we eat in America is never far from how food has been marketed in America. What are some other places where good old entrepreneurial opportunism played into the invention of the American meal?
Well, the first thing, of course, that comes to mind is breakfast cereal. Of course, with snacking, that's really where entrepreneurialism comes in. You have people who are initially just peddling snack foods on the streets, pretzel peddlers and peanut peddlers and people selling popcorn at fairs and circuses and political rallies. And this was a way that a lot of immigrants, you know, made it. They were dirt poor, but they made it in this country in the New World by selling perhaps a food that they brought with them, such as the pretzel being brought from Germany. But then many of them went into business. I think of the two brothers, immigrants from Germany, who started Cracker Jack in Chicago in the late 1800s. And they were the first, really, to take a snack food and process it, basically manufacture it, you know, manufacture it on an industrial scale and put it in a box. And when they put it in a box, it just took on new characteristics. One of the things that happened when they put it in a box was that it was seen as cleaner, purer, and basically less suspicious because snack food had become stigmatized as being associated with rather unhygienic, dirt-poor immigrants with different cultural standards and perhaps because of their different cultural standards, different health standards and hygienic standards. So snack food becomes really just a very fertile area for food entrepreneurs.
It's now a multi-billion dollar industry and something that you were looking into researching originally when you started this book. I understand that you were looking into snacking and the connection with obesity. And I'm wondering about this. Now we know so much more about metabolism, how we process food. There are a lot of recommendations for people to eat a number of smaller meals or graze throughout the day. Talk to me about how the American meal is evolving now.
The meal and the snack have, since the Victorian era, they've had a bit of a contentious relationship. And if you look at studies that have been done just in the past decade or so, you'll see that, you know, we are consuming more calories than we have in the past. But children's intake right now, the gain in calories from meals have not kept up with the gain in calorie from snacks, which is to say that the snack is displacing the meal calorically. And so that's another sort of challenge to the family meal, is the rise of snacking and snack food.
Well, Abigail, you're a food historian. This obviously isn't the first time that you've considered what you're eating. But I wonder, after writing this book and looking at the specifics of how meals have been shaped, but also how they influence our culture, I'm wondering, when you sit down to eat, what are you thinking about?
I think about how little we think about the meal and how entrenched our eating patterns are and how entrenched our sense of what we think we should eat is. You know, when I say that I have soup for breakfast perhaps one day, I think it's very, very jarring for people and very rare to come across somebody who would eat for breakfast something that's not considered a standard breakfast food. And this is, you know, not the case throughout the world. Not everybody eats quote unquote breakfast foods for breakfast. But I've seen just how deep those roots are.
Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, Virginia.
Abigail Carroll is the author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. You can find a link to read an excerpt from the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Cigarettes and chocolate milk. These are just a couple of my cravings.
The one place you probably don't want to visit if you're embarking on a new diet in the new year is the all-you-can-eat buffet. With its dizzying array of choices, the ability to choose a healthy option can pose a challenge even for those with an iron will. Up next, we'll speak to a researcher who's cracked the code and found a way to improve diners' decision-making skills when they hit the buffet. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Everything it seems I like's a little bit sweeter.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. As the year winds to a close, many are making resolutions for the new year. Perhaps revamping your diet is on your to-do list for 2015. Well, in the spirit of rethinking food choices, a team at Cornell University conducted a study to see how we can turn the buffet, that most tempting and often indulgent array of foods, into part of a balanced breakfast. Dr. Andrew Hanks is a researcher for the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. Virginia spoke to him earlier this year about the findings.
I think a lot of people who are supposed to watch what they eat are warned off the all-you-can-eat buffet. It's symbolic of excess and a tendency to overeat. Why were you looking at it?
Sure. It's very common in conferences, for example, or in other, you know, settings with large groups of people. It's an easy way to feed a large group of people and give them options so they can easily, you know, pick what they like. And so we thought, hey, if we just take the standard environment here, what can we do to arrange it and improve what people are eating?
So you did your research at a conference. Tell us about how it was conducted and who were the subjects.
So it was at a human resources conference, and the subjects were actual attendees. And what happened was, as they came into the breakfast room, they were ushered to one of two breakfast lines that served seven items. And on one line, the cheesy eggs, bacon, potatoes, cinnamon rolls, granola yogurt and fruit was displayed with the cheesy eggs first. And the other line, it was completely opposite with the fruit first. And so as they came in, it was one group went to the cheesy eggs first line, and then the next group went to the fruit first line. And so what happened was actually really interesting. 75% of the people in this whole breakfast took the first food they saw most. So 75% took the first food. And then 66% of the people took at least one of the first three foods they saw. And so what that told us was there's a lot of power in this idea of first foods most. Whatever you see first, you're going to take.
So placement is just pretty much the key? I mean, don't people tend to have a script, a meal script that they tend to follow?
Oh, absolutely. It's common. And what we saw with the cheesy eggs first line, there was exactly that, some sort of script where individuals went for the cheesy eggs, and then a high percentage also got either the bacon or the potatoes. But when fruit was offered first, it seemed as if the script was somewhat disrupted, maybe, where people, 96% of the people in that line took the fruit first, and a very low percentage took the cheesy eggs at the end. And there was really no correlation between taking cheesy eggs and bacon and potatoes when fruit was offered first. And that's in contrast to when the eggs were offered first. And so it really shows that when that fruit was offered first, there was no real kind of combination that people were thinking about. And so they ended up taking a healthier breakfast. But when cheesy eggs were, you think, ooh, the eggs, the bacon, potatoes, that's a very standard American breakfast. And so people seem to follow that cultural pattern.
Well, and it's also laid out in front of them like that. And I'm actually wondering about whether hotels, food service, think about the higher margin items or the lower margin items first? Do you know any background there? I mean, do you make more money off of eggs than you do off of granola?
That's a good question. I don't have any numbers right offhand, but I would think that in a buffet setting where, you know, items are, you know, do you play a flat rate, that it might make sense to put some of the, you know, maybe a little more costly items near the front as they're taking it first. Mm. In terms of this particular situation or the actual cost, that's a great question to consider in future research.
How can you put the results of your research to good use? How can you help change the kind of food that people choose?
So I guess, you know, with Thanksgiving coming up and all of us thinking about all the delicious food and pies we'll be eating, just a very simple extension could be in that sort of situation when you lay the food out, place the, you know, the healthier items first, the salad or the vegetables first in line. But I think in a more general context, it could be thought of as arranging an environment to guide individuals to healthier behavior. So in this particular case, the environment was the buffet line. So there were two lines, and in one, fruit was offered first, and the other, cheesy eggs were offered first. But what could be done in, for example, a home environment, or in a school cafeteria environment, or, for example, in a restaurant setting that encourages the healthier eating? I think that's the bigger picture that this research points to, what can be done. And, you know, my research group does a lot of research in school lunchrooms, looking at really simple modifications to a school lunchroom and how that guides children to eat the healthier foods that are on their trays.
Well, Dr. Hanks, thanks for sharing that with us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Andrew Hanks is a researcher for the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab. He published a study about how putting healthy foods first at the buffet reinforces healthy eating. Up next, we take a look at one teenager's bold resolution to lose 300 pounds. That story when Word of Mouth returns.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. The new year is a time for a fresh start, and among the most popular New Year's resolutions, losing weight ranks number one. While many people cut calories and hit the gym to jumpstart their metabolism, others have to resort to more extreme measures. As a teenager, one of WNYC's radio rookies, Samer Rocky Taya, first told listeners about his struggle with obesity. A lot changed for Rocky since he first went on the air. At the age of 19, as a freshman in college, he made a bold decision to undergo weight loss surgery.
When I was 11 years old, I made a promise I couldn't keep. I was on vacation at my uncle's house, and after a fun day of swimming, with my shirt on, of course, I went into the bathroom and nervously stepped on the scale. 200 pounds. So I swore to Allah, something you're not supposed to do in the bathroom, that I wouldn't get any fatter. But I could never slam the door on food, my comfort for life, my best friend in chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry.
You have a choice to lose weight. Just now you ate a pint of ice cream. Is that necessary?
I ate a pint of ice cream just
now.
You
ate a pint of ice cream, strawberry ice cream.
That's my twin sister and me.
Just now,
I recorded it when I was 15 for my first radio story.
Yesterday you ate three bowls of cereal.
It was not strawberry ice. It was fudge ice cream.
The night before my story aired, I thought everyone was just going to hear me as a fat, sad complainer who really didn't want to lose weight.
This message is for Rocky.
But so many people wrote in, and I didn't feel alone anymore.
Despite being a Jewish anorexic, I identified...
That means having healthy munchies around, you know, raisins, fruit.
If Rocky wants to ask me about it, tell him to feel free to email me or call me. Unbelievable.
I went from hiding my problems to telling millions of strangers.
On the Jane Pauley Show.
And when the Jane Pauley Show came knocking, I was fatter than ever.
My name is Rocky. I'm 16.
There I was, in soft focus, with what seemed like my only friends in the world, my cat Simba, and of course, the refrigerator.
I need to lose weight or I'm going to die.
I was on the show with a whole panel of fat kids.
Rachel is so young.
The girl sitting next to me was scheduled to have a new type of weight loss surgery. The lap band, an inflatable ring around the top part of your stomach.
Way too big.
Her surgeon, Dr. George Fielding, told us that diet and exercise for morbidly obese people like me is just hopeless.
And her realistic chances of losing that weight, it's effectively zero.
For a year, those words kept on repeating over and over in my head, like a nonstop washing machine getting louder and louder. I always knew surgery was an option. I just thought of it as a last resort, like for people who are so fat they can't even move. And I wasn't at that point. By my last year of high school, I was 300 pounds overweight. 300 reasons for my mom to be angry and concerned.
I want to see you outside, hang out, have friends, have a life.
I don't have a life?
Not like your brothers, no.
What? Don't make it seem like I'm just a caveman.
But you're not doing nothing, and every week you gain weight.
I'm not doing nothing?
Nothing.
Don't you think dealing with my weight mentally is exhausting?
You're not doing nothing.
I'm dealing with it in my head.
Is your head helping you?
No.
Let's make it clear. I wasn't just a fat boy sitting in the corner looking depressed. At school, I made people know me for more than just a kid who wore a size 64 pants.
Am I funny?
Yeah, you're funny.
So shouldn't that overshadow my size?
Nothing can overshadow your size.
Just like nothing could overshadow your bad grades. No, really, come on.
But I had bigger problems than just coming up with good, quick insults. I had to request an elevator pass to get me up two flights of stairs. And a special desk in each of my classrooms. I weighed 517 pounds. So I made a decision to have surgery and save my life. My brother and sister told me I was taking the easy way out.
You don't even take gym class.
I do take gym class.
No, you don't. Don't lie.
I'm medically excused from gym.
Oh, see?
Sammy,
you put
again,
no effort into
okay,
it.
It's again with my theory.
Do you not wake up in the morning eating a Hershey bar or something? That's issues right there. That's something you have to control in yourself.
Hello. I know I have a weight problem. Okay. My solution to my weight problem is surgery.
No.
My dad told me I wasn't allowed to have the surgery. He thought I should just go to the gym. But in my family, if dad says no, you convince mom. And then, of course, keep it a secret.
Your father doesn't know.
No,
we fill up the closet with Slim Fast. We don't have you on Slim Fast.
Hey, this is Rocky. It's Sunday night and the day before my surgery.
Before I could finally have the operation, I had to go on a two-week low-calorie liquid diet.
I've just been sleeping every day just to get through the day without food, and it's sad to see how strong food has a control over me. But I can do it. I'm ready to say goodbye to food. It's going to kill me if I don't say goodbye. What are we doing today?
You're doing your surgery.
That's my mom and me at the hospital.
How do you feel?
Scared.
What are you afraid of?
God forbid if something happened to you. That's why. That's why I couldn't even look at you. I said, oh my God, if I have something happen to him, what am I going to do with my life?
It was finally time. I put on a blue gown and went into a small room to wait. Wait for my name to be called. Wait for my new life to begin.
It's 11:57, April 10th, the day of my surgery. I had the surgery. I want to cry, but it's going to hurt if I cry. I can't wait to see what my new life has to in store for me. I can't wait.
It's Sunday and I'm in my bathroom. My dad just called me down to eat because my mom made dinner for him. So he's calling me down to eat now and I'm so... Scott, because I can't eat that much, but I'm going down.
I ended up telling my dad right after dinner. I couldn't hold back anymore.
You gotta start excited.
He was surprisingly calm.
Even if I don't agree with it, I'm still going to support you.
And weeks later, he was teasing me about the lap band.
Get ready, big boy. Get that belly. Get that rubber band open. You got a lot of lobsters to eat.
Months after surgery, I was already trying to push the lap band to the limit. First with Pringles, then with Chinese food. My Saturday night dates with TV and food continued. The lap band controlled how much I ate, but it didn't control why I ate. So what do I do when I'm sad, frustrated, or bored?
I feel really full. My body's telling me no, but my mind is telling me yeah. I have to learn to accept it, or I'm just going to keep on throwing up and throwing up and throwing up. There comes the soup. I definitely ate too much. I'm hovering over this thing because I know it's coming out. And there goes my dinner. Back into the sink.
This was it. I thought I found a secret loophole, a way to still eat my emotions away and lose weight. I didn't think there was anything wrong with throwing up.
I went to Dunkin' Donuts to buy like a case of these Dunkin' Donut cups. So when I throw up, I could just throw it up in these cups and then throw the cups away.
But then a nutritionist in my surgeon's office told me the lap band could slip and would have to be removed, and that I might destroy my esophagus.
Do you want it over ice? Or do you want
See you later, hero sandwich. Hello, pumpkin spice latte with half and half. I know I'm supposed to avoid liquid calories, but that's the only thing that can make me feel happy and not make me throw up. And even with my daily trips to Starbucks, I managed to lose 200 pounds in 1 year.
Are you excited?
The last time my friend Letitia saw me, I was huge.
We used to hang out. People used to look at us like, why is that pretty skinny girl with him?
The train was the worst.
Oh, yeah. With the boys. Remember when that movie came out and that boy was calling you Fat Albert?
He was?
Yes, Sam!
When?
There was a hey. That's
reactions have changed. Letitia even says people are looking at us like we're a couple. This is a new person, and I look so good. But Letitia thinks my weight is the only thing different.
Why do you think because you're skinnier you look good? To me, you looked good before.
Oh, don't lie. Don't I look so much better now?
You look better. You look better, but you're still the same person.
But I'm not. I'm not Rocky anymore. I wish this me could have told huge monster Rocky just how better life is, how much more fun life is, how alive I feel. I do want to figure out why I got so big, and I still eat to feel good, like when I'm bored or I can't express how I feel. My body is marked with scars and extra skin, reminding me every day just how big I was. But even now, with another 100 pounds to lose, when I'm walking down the street, I feel like I'm flying, like the wind is pushing me along. And when I see little fat kids, I want to wake them up and tell them before it's too late just how hard life is for a fat teenager, so they won't have to grow up to be like me with a band around their stomach. For WNYC, I'm rookie reporter Samer Rocky Taya.
And a little postscript to Rocky's story. He's now living in Brooklyn and working as a freelance radio journalist and writer. And if you are looking for a little New Year's inspiration, you'll be happy to know he has managed to keep off the weight. Stick around for more word of mouth. Up next, we'll move from food to drink with Olivia Lang. She followed the decline of six of America's greatest alcoholic writers, and she thoroughly debunks the myth of booze as muse. That's coming up when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. The idea of writing a book about writers who drank too much sounds a little like shooting fish in a barrel. The relationship between addiction and creativity remains somewhat mythic and frequently mimicked. Remarkably talented writers and champion boozers like John Cheever, Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Tennessee Williams drank through successes and failures and kept going even as their creativity crumbled and their lives circled the drain. Olivia Lang knows a lot about books and writers. A prolific critic, she's deputy books editor for the British newspaper The Observer. She traveled across the U.S. to follow the paths of those we mentioned, along with John Berryman and Raymond Carver. Six alcoholics, two of whom ended up suicides, the others dead in middle age. Virginia spoke with Olivia about her book, The Trip to Echo Spring, earlier this year.
Well, first, that line from the title, from a Tennessee Williams play, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, if you could set up that scene for us.
Absolutely. So this is what I think is Tennessee Williams' greatest play, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And it's about an alcoholic. It's about Brick, who's a retired injured sports hero who is drowning his sorrows in the bottle. And the play is set in his parents' house, which he lives in too with his wife Maggie the Cat, famously played by Elizabeth Taylor. And over and over again, he makes this limping journey to the liquor cabinet, and he says about it, "I'm just making a little short trip to Echo Spring." And I just fell in love with that phrase. He means literally it's a brand of bourbon. He's just going over to drink some more bourbon. But he means something else as well, I think. And it was that sort of symbolic sense of what an alcoholic is doing when they're drinking and drinking and drinking that I really wanted to get to the heart of.
You put it so nicely, the sentence, "I began to think that drinking may be a way of disappearing from the world."
And actually, I thought about that a lot. It's something about the way that drinking can be used both to escape, I think it's very much an escape, but also to suppress some sense of the self that one despises. So a lot of these guys really suffered from self-hatred, depression, anxiety, these sort of toxic emotions, toxic feelings that I think they were using alcohol to drown out. And to give an example, one of the ones that I really liked the most, I think, is John Cheever, who's a terrific writer. His short stories were extraordinary. He wrote five novels as well. And his drinking had a lot to do with all sorts of senses of anxiety and social unease. But in particular with this, he was married, he was, you know, had a family, but at the same time, his genuine desires were for men. His erotic life was about men, and he couldn't admit that to himself. And it seems to me that the drinking was very much a desire to just bury or drown out those sort of feelings. So I think that Baudelaire quote is really, it's actually quite accurate. Mm. But at the same time, I spoke to psychiatrists, I spoke to neurobiologists to really try and build up a multifaceted portrait of alcoholism as a disease.
You quote John Cheever writing that every comely man was aimed at his life like a loaded pistol. There's so much fear of being discovered, you know, as an imposter to the middle class and a heterosexual. And fear is something that Tennessee Williams writes about in a letter to Elia Kazan, I think, as primary reason that somebody drinks. What are some of the other reasons that writers say they drink? And do you think that those are accurate assessments or some other kind of delusion?
There's all kinds of different answers. Fitzgerald would say things like, "I drink because I'm too sensitive. I drink because I need to loosen my thoughts up." And then later he'd say, "Why did I write that book drunk? I regret that so much." So those are the sort of excuse notes that get wheeled out a lot. And that's all very well. It works very nicely in the beginning.
Today, Olivia Lang is with us to unlock the literary liquor cabinet. She's author of The Trip to Echo Spring. It's a book about the love-hate relationship between six of America's great male writers and alcohol. Now, the one person who continues to boast about his superior capacity to, I guess, handle alcohol was Ernest Hemingway, at least in your book. Do you think he ever questioned whether or not he should be drinking?
As he got older, there was definitely a point around the time that he was writing A Moveable Feast where he was seriously having to take on how out of control his drinking had got and the kind of physical damage it was causing to his body. There's a description of Hemingway at that point with his liver protruding from his stomach like a worm. Mm. That's in somebody's letters. And if you look at his medical records, it's very clear that his body was in a terrible state. His doctors were very concerned, and they put him on a diet where he couldn't drink at all. And these are where you get some extraordinary letters where he talks very honestly about the effect alcohol has on him, about how desperately he needs it. But what's interesting is he admits it, he sort of admits it, but at the same time, he starts writing this book, A Moveable Feast, where he talks over and over again. It's about him and Fitzgerald in Paris in the 20s. And he talks about what a bad drinker Fitzgerald was, what an addict Fitzgerald was, and what a good drinker Hemingway was, how heroic he was, how he wasn't touched by any of it.
Did you notice in their writing this fear that if they stopped, their work would no longer flow? You know, that they somehow saw alcohol as a key to their creativity.
I'm not sure that they directly felt it was a creative stimulant in terms of producing their work. I think it was more that they felt they couldn't cope without it, that their whole sort of personality structure would fall apart. So you have Tennessee Williams writing these letters of, I'm empty, my mind has been destroyed by alcohol, my ability to think has been destroyed by alcohol. And interestingly, those sort of letters are written when he's writing Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, where clearly it hasn't yet happened, but he can feel that it's coming.
How many millions of alcoholics the world over have never published or written a word or have drunk and drugged themselves believing that they could also somehow unlock the muse? Why do you think it worked for these men in particular until it didn't?
Until it didn't, yeah. I think that's a better way of putting it. Because why these guys managed to produce such extraordinary works, and you think of things like A Farewell to Arms, For Whom the Bell Tolls, The Swimmer, these marvellous stories and novels, I think that actually is a mystery. I think that's an absolute mystery. And the other thing that I think is a mystery is how some people managed to recover, how people like John Cheever and Raymond Carver managed to find it in themselves to stop drinking after these years and years of addiction, after all the things they love falling apart, and to still at some point be able to say, I'm going to stop, seems extraordinary to me. And I think that capacity for recovery, which is what I end the book with, is so important to remember.
And you never, ever judge them, which I wouldn't think is easy from a person who grew up around an alcoholic. You write about that in your book. Diana, who was your mother's partner, could become a very bitter and mean drunk. How did you look at these writers? And did it ever cause you to question yourself and what drinking unlocks in you and all people?
I'm glad that you're saying that you felt I didn't judge them, because I think that experience, that childhood experience, really informed my understanding of them and seeing the kind of damage drinking caused them, and also seeing how hard they all tried to stop. Even people who didn't manage, like Berryman, tried so hard at different intervals. And I think there's something about that, something about the humanity of that, that was very moving to me.
Alcoholism remains a real mystery, an addiction in the human brain, despite what we now know about how the brain functions. But there are so many more opportunities to get sober. You know, 12-step programs proliferate. The language of recovery is out there. Do you think had these men lived in other times, it would have been much more likely that they would have gotten sober? And I guess the other question is more speculative. Would their writing have been changed by it?
I think if they had lived later, it would have been a very different story. I think it really is a 20th century story, this one. I think John Cheever's story would have been so different. I find that heartbreaking to think of. If he'd lived 40 years later, I don't think he would have got into anything like that awful sort of sense of shame and self-hatred. And that's one of the things that really breaks my heart about it. The question of what kind of work they would have produced is a really interesting one, because clearly people do produce great work when sober. Some of Carver's most beautiful stories, one of Cheever's greatest books. But the kind of experience that they turned into this sort of process of alchemy, of turning their experience into fiction, I don't know if we would have had that. But I don't know if it's worth it either. It's a hard call.
Well, Olivia Lang, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Olivia Lang is a former deputy books editor at The Observer. She writes and reviews and lectures widely. Her most recent book is called The Trip to Echo Spring. You can find more about the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
Rum, scotch, vodka on the rocks, as long as all his troubles disappear. But he messed up his life, went and beat up his wife, and the flu's he's gone and found another sucker. She's gonna turn him on to drink, she's gonna lead him to the brink, and when his money's gone, she'll never let go. It's such a shame.
We mentioned that the title of Olivia Lang's book, The Trip to Echo Spring, was inspired by a line from Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Williams is best known for his plays, but he also wrote poetry. In 1971, he recited 15 of his early poems for the Key West Library. Fortunately for us, the recording has been preserved.
The eyes are last to go out. They remain long after the face has disappeared regretfully into the tissue that it is made of. The tongue says goodbye when the eyes have a lingering silence, for they are the searchers last to abandon the search. The ones that remain where the drowned have been washed ashore after the lanterns staying, not saying goodbye. The eyes have no faith in that too accessible language. For them, no occasion is simple enough for a word to justify it. Existence in time, not only their own, but ancestral, encloses all moments in four walls of mirrors. Closed, they are waiting. Open, they're also waiting. They are acquainted, but they have forgotten the name of their acquaintance. Youth is their uneasy bird, and shadows clearer than light.
Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories do tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.